without beating this map. The closest he'd come had been yesterday, when he made it into the wine cellars. There, an SS officer shot him in the back after Greg raced past a row of wine tuns. This was what had driven Greg for the last 24 hours straight. After shooting him, the SS officer stood over his body. It was the infamous Oberstleutnant Heinrich Borner from the single-player mode of OTR. Even freakier, Borner spoke over Greg's body. He said,
"Tod ist unvermeidlich, aber meist unbeutend,"
with an English subtitle appearing on the bottom of the screen. Death is inevitable, but largely unimportant. How the fuck had they done that? It was absolutely the same voiceover artist for Borner from the original single-player game. Had this custom map been done by the Cyberstorm folks themselves? Greg was obsessed with reaching the wine cellars again. He had to find out what Borner was doing there. Only this time, he wasn't going to let that fuck shoot him in the back. Yet he knew only too well that Borner was a slippery character, not likely to repeat his tactics. Greg resolved to save grenades for the cellars. The next round started with much of the usual crew. Similarly obsessed folks cursing this addictive game and striving to take the Abbey before dawn broke on another sleepy-eyed workday. This time, Greg made sure to follow in the path of a player whose screen name was Major Pain in the Ass, Mpita. Mpita was a good player, with quick reflexes and a good grasp of key combinations for jumping, switching weapons, and leaning around corners. Greg crawled behind him during the flanking maneuver, then stuck close on his tail going into the monastery ruins. He never let him get more than a step or two ahead. Mpita soaked up most of the gunfire from krauts with Schmeissers and heavy machine guns. By the time Mpita was taken out with a Panzerfaust, Greg was farther into the ruins than he'd ever gotten without taking serious damage. He took out the Panzerfaust team with a couple of blasts from his pump shotgun, his weapon of choice for this map. A sniper rifle was useless in the close quarters of the ruins. Greg then stormed forward, hitting a command key that caused his avatar to shout, "Follow me!" He headed toward the dormitory hall, and that was going to be the next problem. As he reached the corner, Greg hit the key combo to lean left. He quickly spotted the MG-42 team 100 feet down the roofless, rubble-strewn corridor. The loader pointed, shouted, and the gunner turned toward him and opened fire just as Greg ducked back again. Tracers whined past for a moment or two until the Krauts decided to save their ammo. It was an engrossingly realistic game. Greg turned his view to face 5 other Allied players catching up behind him. This was fantastic. They'd never come this far with so few casualties. That meant only 10 of the 16 had been killed in the assault, a record low. He hit the command keys again, and his avatar shouted, "Charge!" He raced straight across the hall toward a shallow alcove he knew of, immediately drawing fire again from the MG-42 at the end of the hall. He watched his health meter drop quickly to 20% by the time he reached the safety of the alcove. The players right behind him tried to follow him into the alcove, but Greg knew it could only fit one player at a time. Their avatars bumped and jumped against his, striving for cover until the Germans mowed them down. 3 other players had hung back under cover, and they exchanged fire with the MG-42 until Greg heard what he was waiting for. Silence from the Kraut machine gun. They were reloading. Greg switched to grenades and charged forward. As he ran over the corpses of his fallen comrades, he picked up their med kits, increasing his health back to 95%. It was an odd genre conceit that fallen players sprouted medical kits like Christmas presents, and that picking up a medical kit would immediately increase the health of injured characters. But right now, Greg was all for it. He wanted Burner's head on a stick. He could see the Krauts wrestling a belt of ammo into the open breech of their gun while he ran toward them. The machine gun barrel steamed ominously. The detail of this game is fantastic. Just as the Krauts slammed the breech closed again, Greg hurled his grenade down the hallway. It was a perfect throw, and the Germans ran, shouting from their machine gun nest. By that time, Greg had switched to his shotgun, and he pumped 2 rounds into each of them as they fled the explosion. They dropped with captivating ragdoll physics. When he reached the smoking machine gun nest, only one of the Krauts was still moving, lying on his back with a 3D texture of blood ostensibly flowing from his mouth. That meant he was 98% wounded. Greg loved this part. Sometimes severely wounded AI soldiers would surrender. The injured Kraut held up his hands with melodramatic fear, looking up at Greg's avatar.
Nicht schießen!
Boom! Greg wasted him and reloaded. The other three surviving members of his squad arrived, reloading their Tommy guns. The chat window started rolling fast and furious now. Sergeant Harry Balls.
Any more grenades?
Your retarded brother.
Never been this far!
Go Mets.
Loki, we'll cover you.
Greg smirked. Like hell, motherfucker. He typed. Loki.
Fuck you, I took out the machine gun.
A moment, then Sergeant Harry Ball's avatar moved toward some cellar steps. The others followed, with Greg taking up the rear. This was the way he liked it. Greg looked down the stairway. That was the entrance to the wine cellar where he'd seen Oberstleutnant Berner yesterday. He was going to kill that fucker this time. Should he warn the others? He calculated whether it was better to share the information and increase the chance of success, or risk it all and keep victory for himself. He decided to let them find out the same way he did. Harry Balls tossed a grenade into the cellar and chased the resulting explosion, charging inside with his Thompson blazing. Suddenly, the doorway filled with an orange glow, and flames leapt out of the cellar with a throaty roar. Flamethrower. Berner was holed up in the cellars with a fucking Flammenwerfer. This was suicide. Harry Balls was already dead. The other two players started tossing grenades in through the opening. They ducked in and out of the doorway, chased by roaring flames each time. Greg knew that they were taking damage, but they were helping. A flamethrower only had 10 blasts. By the time the flamethrower was exhausted, your retarded brother was dead, and Go Mets was badly injured. Greg knew this because a player's avatar limped when it had less than 20% health, and his companion was limping pitifully. Greg let Go Mets grab the med kits from their fallen comrades, since he was of no use to Greg dead, and they both charged into the wine cellar, guns blazing. Berner was nowhere in sight. Greg hoped it was Berner they were chasing, since he was running out of ammo. He typed into the chat window.
Loki, did you see him?
Go Mets.
No!
The wine cellar was dimly lit the last time Greg was here, but now the fires left by the flamethrower illuminated the place pretty well, so they didn't have to probe the dark corners of the room behind the wine barrels. From experience, Greg knew that wood textures could burn in OTR, so they had to move through here fast or they might lose any chance of catching Herr Oberstleutnant at all. Greg glanced up and saw that the beams overhead had caught fire.
Damn! Who designed this level? It's incredible!
A doorway led through the far wall of the cellar. The exhausted flamethrower pack lay on the stone floor there. An echoing German voice shouted from that direction.
Americana!
It was Berner, all right. Greg rushed forward with Go Mets, and they took up positions on either side of the doorway. Greg started leaning in to take a look when he saw the infamous Heinrich Berner character stand up from the cover of some crates behind Go Mets. Berner was dressed in his trademark SS officer grays with a floor-length greatcoat and an iron cross under his chin. This bastard son of an AI engine had dropped the flamethrower in the exit to make them think he'd left the room, and they both fell for it like morons. Berner leveled a Schmeisser submachine gun at Go Mets' back and opened up. To his credit, Go Mets leapt up like a house cat and spun around, firing wildly with his Thompson. Greg tried to pump a few rounds in Berner's general direction, but Go Mets was blocking the line of fire. By the time Greg circled around and Go Mets limped to cover, Berner was moving behind the huge wine tuns again, his evil laugh echoing.
Fucker, fucker, fucker!
Greg actually shouted at his flat-screen monitor. Just then, he heard the telltale clink-clank of a German potato masher landing in his general vicinity.
Fuck!
Greg ducked down and scurried away, but he was still caught by the blast and went flying across the room. He was suddenly down to 15% health.
Damn it!
He pounded his workbench. The grenades kept coming, and both Greg and Go Mets fell back, firing at nothing in particular. By the time they stopped, they were damn near back at the cellar entrance. Embers were falling down around their ears. Greg lost another 1% of health in fire damage. Greg tilted his view upward to see the ceiling fully engulfed in flames. The place was filling with smoke. A beam in the corner collapsed, sending up sparks. Incredible effects. Greg turned his view to Gomet's avatar. The guy looked like hell, swaying unsteadily and wheezing. Greg aimed the shotgun. Boom! Gomet's fell dead. Greg collected his med kit and was back up to 39% health again.
PKing's a bitch, fella.
Then Greg realized he was out of shotgun shells. He also had no grenades left. He switched to his Colt pistol. This was laughable. He was up against Burner with a pea shooter.
Good as dead now. Might as well go out fighting.
Greg's avatar ran like a wild man across the burning cellar, firing his pistol at nothing in particular. He ran to the doorway on the far side and jumped over the discarded flamethrower pack. He ran full speed into the darkness. It was with considerable surprise that he found himself still alive and moving toward a faint light ahead. He stopped to reload his pistol and then continued. Soon, he reached a circular chamber with a beam of sunlight shining down from a hole in the ceiling, illuminating a section of the wall. It appeared to be the basement of a shattered tower. Several barred windows ringed the walls in the shadows. It was a dead end. Greg looked back the way he'd come. No wonder Burner let him in here. Now he was trapped. Greg wondered why Gomez wasn't flaming him in the chat window for player killing. Perhaps if any of the first squad survived the diversion attack, he could convince them to move up and help out. Greg hit the tab key to bring up the player list. To his surprise, no one else was playing on the server anymore. There weren't even any spectators, which is what you turned into after getting killed. All 31 human players had disconnected. It was strange. He closed the player list. Maybe they were shunning him for player killing? Greg's avatar moved around the dark room. He noticed the wall where the sunlight struck it. There, in the center of the sunlight, a texture map of chiseled stone spelled out a cryptic message. M0WFG3PRCOJVT7JCGBWSOXB3U7YPXBB. Greg stared at it for a while. What the hell? Just then, he heard a familiar voice off to his left.
Americana.
Greg spun left and emptied his Colt in the direction of the voice. It was Burner, all right, standing behind a latticework grate cut into the wall. His shadowy form was partially hidden by the grate. The bullets didn't seem to have any effect. Apparently, the game engine treated the latticework as a solid object, like a bulletproof confessional. In a few seconds, Greg's pistol was empty. As he stood there, his gun still aimed at Burner, the SS officer took out a lighter and lit a cigarette at the end of a long black filter. The orange glow lit up his hawkish Aryan face for a moment. The Oberstleutnant's dark eyes turned to Greg's avatar.
You have played long. Have you no job?
Greg's jaded eyes widened in amazement.
Who the hell created this map?
Burner continued to smoke calmly. On a lark, Greg hit a hotkey for game taunts. His avatar shouted at Burner.
I think the Germans are out of real men.
Burner frowned.
Stop such nonsense.
At his computer, Greg stood up, kicked his chair back, and gripped his head in mute amazement. His eyes quickly returned to the screen. Burner took another drag on his cigarette.
Are you a brain-dead punk?
He motioned to the text centered in the sunlight on the wall.
Or do you have useful knowledge, yes? If you do, use your key and we will meet again.
He clenched his teeth on the cigarette filter, smiled darkly, then turned and walked away, laughing his, literally, trademark evil laugh. It echoed in the halls. Greg watched him go, then turned to face the writing on the wall again. He hit a key combination for the in-game camera to snap a screen capture. The moment he did so, he was ejected from the game. The Houston Monte Casino server never appeared in the public listings again. Chapter 10, In the Air. Ross leaned against Seebeck's unmarked police cruiser. It was parked on the shoulder of Potrero Road.
Do you need directions to Woodland Hills, Sergeant?
Just a brief detour.
What is this, the first murder scene?
Down that dirt road.
Seebeck pointed back at a closed steel gate. He stood in front of the steel winch box. A police warning tag hung from the winch housing. Seebeck noticed that the steel cable was roiled on the ground beyond the chain-link fence, stretching out of sight downhill. The county probably lowered it to avoid any additional accidents.
Hang on a sec.
Seebeck keyed a handheld radio.
Unit 992, this is D-19, over.
Seebeck looked to Ross again.
We have a patrol unit guarding the murder scene down below.
A voice crackled over the radio.
Unit 992, over.
I'm at your 20. I need to raise this cable. Is the area clear down there? Over.
10-4, area clear, D-19, over.
Stand by, out.
Seebeck clipped the radio onto his belt under his sports coat. He produced a Ziploc bag from his pocket and unrolled it. It contained keys and a remote control. He removed the keys and flipped through them. He used one to unlock the winch housing. He flipped open the door, then searched for the key to the winch. He inserted the key and turned it in the lock. The winch motor kicked to life, grinding like a powerful can opener. Seebeck leaned around the side of the winch housing to check the progress of the cable.
It wasn't budging.
Ross looked on from his position at the car.
You turning it the right way?
Seebeck stopped it. He pointed to the arrows next to the lock.
It says in. I'm turning it to in. This is out.
He cranked it the other way. The winch paid out a small bit of cable before clicking to a stop.
See? That's out.
Seebeck cranked it the other way again. The motor ran, but it didn't even retrieve the small amount he had just paid out. The winch mechanism would not engage even though the motor was running. He stopped it and pulled the key out.
That's strange. Although now that I think about it, the handyman said the cable didn't come out of the ground when he ran the winch.
Ross looked puzzled.
The cable was in the ground?
Yeah. It was buried in the ground, and the handyman got a faked email from the management company to come over and run the winch.
Ross came up alongside and studied the winch housing.
If running the winch doesn't do anything, why bother to send a spoofed email to have someone run it?
It is strange. The FBI lab will probably take it apart.
Seebeck pulled out a pad and pen. He started writing down brand, model, and serial numbers from the winch.
Any writing on that side?
Ross shook his head. In a moment, they were done, and Seebeck put his pad away.
I want to take another look at the murder scene while I'm here. It'll only be a few minutes.
They returned to the cruiser. Before getting back into the car, Seebeck pulled the remote control from the Ziploc bag and pointed it at the gate. He clicked it. The gate squeaked once, then started swinging open. Another familiar sound came to Seebeck's ears, and he cocked his head to listen closely. Ross's hand slapped across his chest, startling him. He glared at Ross, who was pointing. Seebeck followed his finger. The winch was running, pulling the steel cable taut. It took the final clang of the gate stopping to rouse them from their stunned silence. The cable was taut as piano wire. Seebeck looked at Ross. Ross pointed at the remote.
Whose remote is that?
Seebeck looked down at it, then nodded appreciatively.
It belonged to Joseph Pavlos, the victim.
Ross nodded back.
That's about right, otherwise the cable might be discovered too early and the murder attempt would fail.
Seebeck pondered it.
But then, why send someone out here to run the winch if the key didn't do anything? Like you said, why fake the work order?
They both thought about it for a few moments. Ross turned to Seebeck again.
What was the first thing you did after finding out the handyman ran the winch?
We detained him and requested a search warrant for the property management office.
And how much time did you spend waiting for the warrant and searching the office?
Seebeck grimaced.
Long enough for the second victim to die.
So maybe it was a distraction to give him time to kill the second programmer.
Then the bigger question is, why was it so important to kill these programmers?
Ross frowned. Seebeck watched him closely.
What?
Ross hesitated.
The Egyptian pharaohs slew the workers who built their pyramids.
The programmers knew too much.
Maybe. Maybe Sobel had some help to code this thing. He was dying of cancer, after all.
But why on earth would they help him? Pavlos rode his dirt bike out here all the time. He'd have to notice this was designed to kill him.
Ross leaned back against the hood of the car.
I'm guessing they didn't design this part. Sobel probably did that. They probably coded other parts, maybe parts we haven't seen yet.
They stood there a moment in silence, weighing the significance of this. Ross was the first to break the silence.
It's interesting that this Singh guy died trying to get into a server farm.
Why is that interesting?
Well, a server farm is basically a big data storage vault, racks and racks of servers.
Yeah, so?
So if I were a programmer trying to get a secret cache of data, or to physically stop some machine from running, perhaps I'd head for that server farm?
Seebeck leaned onto the car hood next to Ross.
Okay, so Singh, who probably works closely with Pavlos, hears about Pavlos' death and makes a beeline for the server farm. Sobel anticipated this and kills him when he tries to enter. So you think there's something in the server farm?
Probably not anymore. It sounds like Sobel found whatever Singh put there. So, what was Singh working on at Cyberstorm, do you know?
Seebeck strained to remember the name of Singh's project.
Singh was lead programmer for a game called, Gate.
The Gate?
Yeah, The Gate.
Ross let out a pained groan.
What now?
Do you know the storyline for The Gate, Sergeant?
Seebeck gave Ross a look. Clearly, he did not.
It's about a cult opening a gate to the abyss and releasing a demon that lays waste to the world.
Seebeck just stared at him.
Ross laughed. I'm talking about Sobel's game, Sergeant. I don't believe in demons and devils.
Good, you had me worried for a second.
The only demon I'm worried about is the Unix variety. There's a delicious irony here that I don't think Sobel would be able to resist. You'd know what I'm talking about if you played his games. Now, consider this. The Gate is an MMORPG.
What the hell is that?
A massively multiplayer online role-playing game.
And what the hell is that?
It's a persistent 3D game world experienced simultaneously by tens of thousands of players over the internet.
Seebeck pointed at Ross.
Okay, now that sounds bad.
In this case, it's very bad.
Well, the feds powered down the whole server farm last night. There's not a pocket calculator running over at Cyberstorm now. So whatever he planned is...
Ross didn't look reassured. Seebeck persisted.
I mean, hell, whoever did this couldn't put tens of thousands of steel cables and electrocution traps in people's houses. Failing that, this is basically just another computer virus.
Ross jerked his thumb.
I need my laptop.
He walked back and pulled his laptop case from the rear seat. He laid it on the trunk and unzipped the top compartment. Seebeck walked up to him.
What are you doing now?
Ross had a credit card-sized device in his hand. He scanned the area with it.
I'm seeing if there's a Wi-Fi signal in this area.
He looked to Seebeck.
And there is.
He pointed to the meter on the device, which indicated a strong signal. Seebeck took the device and examined it while Ross started unpacking his laptop.
Okay, so what's this prove?
Ross pointed to the gate down the road.
We need some indication that we're on the right track.
And this does that?
Well, for starters, it confirms that gate or the winch could be wirelessly hooked into the internet.
Like the black box over at Cyberstorm.
Right. It means a living human being didn't have to be involved in this. The news report said Joseph Pavlos went riding down here just about every day. That means his gate remote only became a murder weapon after Sobel died.
Seebeck nodded.
Meaning the demon told the gate to kill Pavlos after it read the news of Sobel's death.
That's what I'm thinking. Now we'll see what I can glean from this wireless network.
Seebeck leaned over Ross's shoulder as his laptop booted up.
What are you looking for?
The usual, whatever I can find.
Ross logged onto his laptop, shielding his logon from Seebeck.
Then he launched NetStumbler and waited for it to initialize. This is a freeware program that helps me see wireless networks.
I'm not computer illiterate, John. I have a wireless network at home.
Ross turned the laptop so the wireless card faced the Wi-Fi signal, and he almost pushed his laptop off the trunk lid. He caught it just in time, held on to it, and continued scanning. In a moment, Ross smiled.
Oh, yeah. I picked up an AP.
His face suddenly got serious. He looked up at Seebeck. Seebeck moved over to him.
What?
If there's one thing I know from playing Sobel's games, it's this. Time works against you. You need to act fast or you're dead.
Okay, and?
Ross turned the laptop around for Seebeck to see. Seebeck leaned down. The single entry in the NetStumbler window showed text under a column labeled SSID. The text read simply, DAEMON_63.
I'd say there's more trouble coming, Sergeant.
Seebeck pointed.
Get in the car.
Chapter 11, The Voice.
DailyVariety.com. San Francisco network affiliate KTLZ signed Hu Lin Chi to a 2-year contract as Lifestyles reporter, replacing veteran Angie Anderson. The move is seen as part of the network's overall strategy to reach a younger, hipper, more ethnically diverse demographic.
Anderson was nearing 40 minutes on the stair climber. Her workout music mix drowned out everything except the pain. The sweat and the rage poured from her body. How could they replace her? She wasn't old, not yet. She kept driving forward. The Bay Club was pricey and exclusive, filled with high-powered business types and trophy wives. More than once, she thought she saw them whispering and pointing. Her professional demise was in the trades. She burned with humiliation. Without another network-level job, she couldn't afford this gym, much less her condo. Her credit card balances kept her driving forward, legs burning. She had saved nothing. She had been projecting an image of success. The reality of her modest roots was something she'd tried to hide even from herself. Her artificial world was coming down around her ears. They'd call it vanity. No one would understand that it was more than that. It was ambition. It was a willingness to risk everything. Wasn't that admirable? Anderson's cell phone lit up and vibrated on the tray in front of her. She stopped and pulled her earbuds out. She steadied her breathing and considered not answering it. It vibrated again. It could be Melissa with news of a job. She checked the display. The caller's number was unknown. Anderson let it ring one more time, then answered it.
This is Angie.
Is this Angie Anderson?
It was a strangely clipped and measured voice. A woman. British. This is she.
Was that a yes?
The sound was odd. It must be an overseas call. Yes, I'm Angie Anderson. Who is this? There was a pause.
I'm calling to let you know about a new story. A story that's about to happen.
I don't know how you got this number.
You just lost your job. I can give you a big news story. Are you interested?
Anderson just stood there trying to decide. What was this? Some sort of telemarketing scam? Was it another stalker?
I didn't hear you say anything. Do you want the information? Just say yes or no.
She tried to imagine what Christiane Amanpour would do. Okay, I'm listening.
Okay is not yes or no. You must understand, before we continue, that this is not a person. This is an interactive voice system. It can only understand certain things you say.
Anderson hung up. Damn telemarketers. Her phone rang again almost immediately. She let it go to voicemail.
Psycho telemarketers.
She looked around for someone who might be staring at her. No one seemed to be watching. Her phone beeped and the text voice message appeared on her display. She stared at the text, waiting for the phone to ring again. It did not. She speed dialed her voicemail and put the phone to her ear, then pulled it away again and tapped in her voicemail password. Phone to ear once more.
The familiar computer voice said,
"You have one new message."
The message played. It was that measured female British voice again.
"Angie, watch the news tonight. The biggest news story in the world is about to occur in Thousand Oaks, California. The next time I call, perhaps you'll listen."
Anderson saved the message. Should she tell someone? Should she call the police? What if the voice was telling the truth? She thought about that again. What if it was telling the truth? She considered it some more, then grabbed her water bottle and hurried toward the locker room. Chapter 12, Opening the Gate. From Eichorn Stanley J. to Patrol Officers, Major Crimes Unit, Bomb Unit. Subject, Warrant Service at Sobel Estate. Body text. East County SD will assist the FBI today in service of a search warrant at the Sobel Estate, 1215 Potrero Road. Deputies on the second shift will be carried over until 6 p.m. this evening. Deputies assigned to the FBI search must arrive 1 hour early for a briefing in room 209. Bomb squad members report to room 202 at 11 a.m. Seebeck and Ross drove down Potrero Road past the Arabian horse farms and neo-antebellum mansions set amid the rolling hills. It was warm and sunny now. California oaks shaded the road and clustered densely around wrought iron entrance gates flanked by white split rail fences and stone walls. Most of the mansions were set back far from the road and hidden behind hills and hedges. The spicy scent of hay perfumed the air. Ross studied the scenery.
"Where are we going, Sergeant?"
"Sobel's estate. The FBI is there."
"I thought you were taking me back to my car."
"I need you to show the FBI exactly what you showed me back there."
"Look, they know where to find me if they have any questions."
"That's just it. I'm afraid they won't. And I'm not sure that any of their forensics experts have played Sobel's games before."
The police dispatcher's voice came over the radio. Seebeck grabbed the handset.
"This is D-19. I'm 1097 at 1215 Potrero Road, out."
He looked to Ross.
"We're here."
Seebeck turned left past two marked patrol cars guarding the open gates of a large estate. He nodded to the deputies standing nearby and rolled past them, heading down the long driveway flanked by lines of mature oaks. In between the trunks, they caught glimpses of a fine Mediterranean villa some distance ahead. This wasn't a modern replica. It looked like an authentic 1920s-era mansion with a cupola and slanting roofs capped in terracotta tile. The mansion was set back about 1,000 feet from the road, nestled in a copse of manzanita trees. Ross whistled. Seebeck nodded.
"Yeah, I didn't know there was so much money in computer games."
"They generate more revenue than all of Hollywood."
The driveway ended in a wide cobblestone courtyard flanked by a horse stable, a six-car garage, and what looked to be a guest house or office. The main house lay straight ahead with landscaped lawns opening the courtyard on either side. Through these openings, Seebeck saw sweeping views of the estate grounds. More than a dozen police vehicles were parked in the courtyard. FBI sedans, county patrol cars, a forensics van, an ambulance, and the bomb squad's truck with a disposal trailer. But there was room to spare. The courtyard was large. Seebeck pulled up behind a sedan with white government plates. He and Ross got out. A couple dozen officers stood near the entrance to the main house. They were listening to Neil Decker addressing them from the steps leading up to the mansion's heavy wooden door. It was a mix of county and local police, along with federal agents wearing blue windbreakers with the letters FBI stenciled on the back. It was impossible to hear what Decker was saying at this distance. Nathan Mance came up to Seebeck as he and Ross took in the scene.
"Hey, Pete, you're just in time."
"How'd it go at the permit office?"
Mance shook his head.
"No permit pulled for the winch housing. The gate was installed by a big GC named McKenzer and Sons. Licensed, bonded, legit. Nothing in the permit applications about a winch. I put a call into McKenzer's office and they're checking their records."
Mance looked to Ross.
"You're that computer guy the feds were holding."
He extended his hand.
"Detective Nathan Mance."
Ross shook his hand.
"John Ross. I was cleared, by the way." Seebeck kept his eye on the crowd of agents in the distance.
Yeah, turns out Mr. Ross here is quite an expert on a few subjects. I brought him out to the canyon scene and he shed some light on things. I've got some important information for Decker.
Seebeck pointed to Decker addressing the troops.
What are the feds up to?
They're preparing to search the house. FBI bomb squad and forensics teams came up from L.A. Decker's treating this as a hazardous search.
Ross nodded.
He's right, it is.
Mance gave him a curious look. Seebeck jerked a thumb at Ross.
He thinks it's Sobel, not somebody at Cyberstorm. Now he's got me wondering.
Mance nodded, impressed.
Really?
Seebeck tore a page out of his small notepad and handed it to Mance.
Nathan, do me a favor. Here's the manufacturer and serial number on the winch assembly. When we get back to the station, check with the factory to see if they have a record of the wholesaler they shipped it to. Let's find out what else was purchased.
No problem.
Mance pocketed the piece of paper. Seebeck walked toward the gathered officers. Ross and Mance followed. They passed three FBI agents preparing a tracked bomb disposal robot. Ross took a keen interest, peering over their shoulders as they tested the video cameras with a large remote control. They were having problems. The operator smacked the handheld controller.
Try channel 4. Is the picture any clearer?
Seebeck tugged Ross along. Decker was still addressing the troops.
Papers, computers, electrical components, tools. Virtually everything should be considered dangerous until the bomb squad marks a room as clear. If you find a device...
Decker leaned down as Agent Straub said something to him. Decker looked up again at the crowd.
Hang on. Is anyone else having radio problems?
Most of the officers held up their hands and voiced in the affirmative. Seebeck noticed a man in his 50s and a woman in her 40s standing among the FBI agents. The two civilians looked pensive. Seebeck turned to Mance. Mance responded.
The caretaker and the security guard. Husband and wife. Sobel's widow lives in Santa Barbara. They separated before his death. And get this. She told them she couldn't live in the house because she'd heard voices. They're tracking her down as we speak. I was hoping she'd be here.
Mance pulled a folded magazine page out of his jacket pocket. He unfolded it to reveal a photo of a tanned and beautiful blonde wearing a string bikini and stretched out on the wet sand of a tropical beach.
The Widow Sobel, Miss New Zealand 2001.
Seebeck grabbed the page.
Holy shit.
Ross leaned in.
Wow.
Mance grabbed it back.
Show some respect, she's in mourning.
He folded it and put it back into his jacket pocket.
Sobel may have died of cancer, but I still envy the bastard.
Seebeck was already walking toward the crowd of agents and officers. He waded through them, headed directly for Assistant Chief Eichhorn.
Hey, Chief.
Seebeck stepped aside and gestured toward Ross.
This is John Ross, the computer consultant from Alcyon.
Chief Eichhorn nodded toward Ross.
One of the guys the feds brought in.
They cleared him this morning. I was bringing him back to Woodland Hills, and I stopped by the Pavlos scene to get serial numbers. Mr. Ross detected a wireless device there. He has some pretty mind-blowing theories about how Sobel's doing all this. I think Decker should talk to this guy.
Pete, the FBI brought in experts from L.A. and Washington.
Yeah, but I don't know how many of them have spent serious time playing in Sobel's games. Mr. Ross has.
I can't vet Mr. Ross's skills. No offense. Can you, Pete?
Somebody technical should listen to him.
Suddenly, the FBI robot crew leader stepped between them and called up to Decker on the patio.
The robot's a no-go, Neil. There's signal interference. This guy probably has spread-spectrum radio towers or something inside.
Decker looked around.
Should we have the city cut power to the house?
The lead operator conferred with the other two, then looked up to Decker.
The computer forensics team will want to keep the power on, otherwise they might lose computer memory evidence.
Decker nodded vigorously.
Of course, I knew that.
He spoke softly with Agents Straub and Knowles. After a moment, he looked up again and announced,
Okay, we go to Plan B. The bomb squad goes in with fiber optics. Gerner, get your crew ready.
Three heavily padded men with high Kevlar collars, bulletproof helmets, and plastic toolboxes moved through the crowd. The officers made way for them. Decker motioned with both arms.
Let's move it back behind the vehicles, people.
The crowd of officers moved back through the parked cars and gathered on the far side. Decker followed them.
Seebeck gave a look to Chief Eichhorn, then approached Decker.
Agent Decker, I've got important information from the canyon scene.
Let me resolve this first, Sergeant.
Decker tried his radio again and then conferred with the bomb squad. Seebeck leaned on a nearby car hood and looked to Ross.
If Sobel is behind the murders, we should find some evidence of it here.
Ross looked around.
Look, the FBI knows where to reach me, Sergeant. I really just want to get back to my hotel and salvage my client list.
Not until I get you in front of Decker.
Agent Andrew Gurner was proud of his team. Rick Lyman and Frank Chapman had served with him in the FBI Explosives Unit through 4 years and scores of bomb calls in the U.S. and abroad, real ones and hoaxes. Between them, they had 35 years of experience. As a demining expert with the 101st Airborne, Gurner had extensive field expertise in demolitions, booby traps, improvised explosive devices, and cell phone detonators. He'd cleared mines from Bosnia to Iraq and spent 2 years as an explosives instructor at Quantico. His companions had military experience with Special Forces and Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. It was a top-notch crew. Decker's briefing laid out the details of the two earlier killings and that this Sobel guy was some kind of genius. Gurner clucked his tongue inside his helmet. He'd seen a lot of clever devices in his day. They were all sitting in his lab, diffused. He turned to his partners and nodded. Lyman and Chapman nodded back. Far behind them, the gathered officers gave the thumbs-up sign. Gurner started by taking the fiber-optic snake out and flipping up his visor. He looked for a gap wide enough to slip it under the mansion's front door. It was a tight seal. Looked like an authentic Spanish mission door. Too bad. He motioned to Lyman, who leaned forward and drove a hole through it with a battery-powered drill. Gurner fed the snake through the hole and put his eye to the lens. He turned the snake this way and that, examining every angle of the room beyond the door.
Christ, that's a nice floor.
Probably Venetian marble. He'd just laid ceramic tile in his downstairs bathroom at home, and he had a greater appreciation of these things now. He examined the twin staircases curving down from a single landing above the foyer. There were three ground floor doorways, not including the front door. The foyer was probably 20 feet deep and 30 feet wide. The millwork was nicely done, right down to the baseboards. He moved back and gave a hand signal to Lyman, who stepped forward with a frequency detector. Lyman moved the detector along the door jamb and the face of the door itself. He watched the LCD readout intently.
This thing's going nuts!
He pulled it away from the door and just held it there.
It's still going nuts. I'm getting signals on all frequencies.
Interesting.
For a moment, Gurner considered using an explosive sheet to blast an opening through the door, but the antique oak was reinforced with black iron bands and was probably several inches thick. Power saws would also be tricky. Sparks from cutting the iron might set off fire detection systems.
Got the caretaker's key?
Chapman leaned forward and placed it in Gurner's heavily gloved hand. He was surprised by the key's weight. You could break a window with it. He examined it closely, a straight brass rod with a crystal embedded on its end. Or was that a diamond? He looked at the lock. Custom. The mechanism was most likely attuned to the precise vibrating frequency of the crystal when subjected to an electrical current. Some sophisticated shit. He looked to his partners.
Window.
They moved down to the nearest large window. It was off to the right about 15 feet. Gurner peered through the glass. Beyond lay a living room with a high, beamed ceiling, stucco walls, and a large fireplace. Tall bookshelves lined the walls. A sofa and authentic-looking mission furniture were placed tastefully about the room. He spotted at least two motion sensors in the upper corners near the ceiling. Sprinkler caps dotted the ceiling as well. It made sense, this far from the road. It also meant there was an emergency fire pump or a fire department hookup outside. He didn't remember seeing that in the blueprints. He kept looking through the window.
Lyman, are there sprinkler heads shown on the blueprints?
Gurner heard his partners flipping through the plans.
Not shown.
Damn it, the plans aren't accurate.
He looked closely at the edges of the window frame. He shined a mag light into the corners. No visible sensors, but he knew it was alarmed.
Decker had ordered Gurner to treat the place as a potential death trap. In light of the electrocution at Cyberstorm, Gurner intended to. He considered the front door key again, then led his team back to the front door.
The caretaker deactivated the alarm and used her front door key just this morning without incident. I say we do the same.
He looked to the other two. Lyman and Chapman nodded. Lyman handed him a short pole with a gripping claw on the end. Gurner took it and fitted the key onto its end. He extended his arm and, using a steady hand, inserted the key into the lock. There was no need to turn it. It emitted a loud click. He let go of the key and used the pole to depress the lever doorknob. He took a deep breath, then nudged it inward. It opened very smoothly for such a large door. They peered inside. Lyman tried to get a frequency reading again, while Chapman pulled an aerosol can from his toolbox. Chapman looked to Gurner, who nodded. Chapman sprayed a smoky mist evenly into the foyer doorway. All three men scanned the smoke-filled air for laser beams. Nothing. Gurner gave the hand signal to advance. He was first through the door, prodding ahead with the pole. He slowly skirted the edge of the foyer and looked around the room. It was gorgeous. His partners followed him inside. Lyman slipped a plastic wedge underneath the front door to keep it open. Gurner checked his radio.
Blue team leader, this is Unit B. Do you copy? Over.
There was nothing but static. Lyman looked at him.
This whole place is a storm of radio signals.
Suddenly, they heard a noise of movement upstairs, like someone walking around. Footsteps echoing on hardwood. They looked at each other. Gurner grabbed his radio.
Blue team leader, we've got someone in here. Do you read?
Still static. Just then, a voice called out clearly from the end of the hallway upstairs.
Who's there?
The voice echoed in the marble foyer. Gurner unsnapped his holster cover and raised his visor.
This is the FBI. Show yourself with your hands on your head.
No reply. But they heard walking again. The footsteps came down the marble stairs to their right, some distance away from them. They could clearly see the staircase, but no one was there. They could hear the sound of a hand sliding down the metal railing. Instinctively, they all drew their pistols. Lyman smacked Gurner in the arm.
Jesus, what are we, idiots? This is a trick!
He still didn't lower his pistol. Gurner focused on the staircase.
I know, but it's a fucking impressive one.
The footsteps were moving across the floor to them now. Gurner motioned toward the front door.
Let's back it up, guys.
Then, in midair, not 5 feet in front of them, a man's voice shouted,
You don't belong here.
What happened next surprised even the veteran Gurner. The deepest sound he'd ever felt passed over him and through him. Then, it was quiet. Until the mission table near him began to vibrate so violently it started moving across the floor. A crystal vase on top of it shattered. Suddenly, Gurner felt as though someone grabbed his intestines straight through his Kevlar suit. He didn't even have time to warn Lyman and Chapman before he was doubled over on the marble floor, vomiting. His guts felt like writhing snakes trying to climb out of his body. The agony was intense. His whole being was gripped with a deep and primordial feeling of dread, like a palpable evil had climbed inside him. Gurner was a man of science and reasoning, but his entire knowledge of the world fled, leaving him alone on the floor weeping in terror. He crawled away through his vomit, listening to insane shrieking. Then he realized the shrieks were coming from him. Seebeck, Ross, and Mance stood with the gathered officers in the courtyard. A moment ago, they had heard Gurner shout a warning to someone in the house. Chief Eichhorn leaned over to the caretaker to confirm that no one else was in the mansion. Seebeck's cell phone twittered. He pulled it from his belt clip.
Seebeck.
A voice he vaguely recognized said, Detective Seebeck, I just needed to know where you were. The connection dissolved in a flurry of static. Mance noticed Seebeck's stunned expression.
Who was it, Pete?
Seebeck stared at his phone, then looked to Ross.
I'm not certain, but I think that was Matthew Sobel.
That's when the shrieking began.
They were the most blood-curdling shrieks Seebeck had ever heard, like a man burning alive. Agents and officers pelted toward the front door. Before they got far, Decker shouted, "Don't go inside! Stay clear!" They slowed for a second, but then they saw Lyman clawing his way out the open front door on his hands and knees. His Kevlar vest was covered in vomit, and his helmet was off. He was bleeding from the nose, eyes, and ears, and groped along as if blind. Seebeck and some of the others rushed to his aid. Lyman was still 60 feet away from them. Eichhorn and Decker shouted for caution, and with all eyes looking forward, no one noticed the middle garage door silently rise behind them. The first warning they received was the guttural sound of a powerful engine, then screeching tires. Seebeck and the other officers turned to face a full-sized black Hummer roaring out of the garage. It bore down on the nearest of them and crushed a deputy and an FBI agent into the side of an FBI sedan, hitting it so hard the car slid into the police cruiser behind it. Seebeck stood in a paralysis of incomprehension. He could clearly see that no one was driving the Hummer. It sported 6 tall whip antennas, still wagging from the impact of the collision. And it had odd-looking sensors bolted to its hood, roof, and fenders. The Hummer's engine roared as it backed away from the wrecked car, and the bodies tumbled onto the paving stones. The Hummer's pushbar bumper was barely dented and covered in blood. It all happened so fast. 2 men had just been killed. Adrenaline flooded into Seebeck's system. People ran in every direction, shouting. Seebeck looked back to the door of the mansion to see the other 2 bomb squad members running out of the house, screaming. One of them stumbled down the front steps and fell into the flower beds, where he went into convulsions. Deputies and FBI agents drew pistols and fired at the Hummer as it screeched around the edge of the courtyard, building up speed again. Shots cracked in rapid succession, echoing against the side of the house. The familiar, pungent smell of smokeless powder brought Seebeck to his senses, and he pulled his Beretta from its holster. He rammed its slide back, gripped it with both hands, then opened fire. He aimed for the Hummer's tires. Seebeck could clearly see bullet impacts on the tires, but they had no effect. The tires were either run flat or solid rubber. He brought up his aim to the windows, but remembered there was no one to shoot at. Now the Hummer howled straight back toward them. Deputies and agents fired a few frantic last shots before scrambling from between the parked police vehicles. It crashed into the side of another patrol car, halving the car's width and driving it back like a battering ram into 2 more cruisers. Those cars smashed into the patio wall, pinning a couple of officers there. The sheer force and loudness of the crash sent Seebeck running for the nearest high ground, a garden wall. Screams of pain came to his ears from the pinned officers. He looked back and saw the Hummer seesawing backward as its gears whined. It swung wide and winged a fleeing officer with its fender. The man went rolling across the courtyard. Turning on him, the Hummer screeched forward before he could get up. The deputy went shrieking under its wheels. His body was dragged halfway across the courtyard before it fell loose. Seebeck screamed in rage and emptied his pistol at the rear of the Hummer while it chased down 2 agents fleeing toward a garden pond. An agent with a pump shotgun ran up to it as it passed by. He fired 2 rounds into it, blasting out its windows and sending pieces of plastic flying. He kept firing as it drove on. Shouts filled the courtyard now. Nearby, Seebeck saw Decker screaming into his radio, "Do you copy?" Back at the estate gates, Deputy Carla Gleason stood taking in the sun and watching for the expected arrival of the media. There hadn't been any radio calls from the mansion, which was odd, but she stood next to her patrol car, attentive and wondering what the mansion would fetch on the real estate market. Across the driveway, Deputy Gil Trevetti stood next to his cruiser, waving a curious passenger car on by. That's when the crackling of gunfire reached her ears. She and Trevetti exchanged looks, then ran for the fence line. Everything looked normal. The mansion was partially masked by trees, so none of the police vehicles were visible from here. But now, the gunfire crackled like firecrackers. It was an unbelievable amount of sustained shooting. Maybe it was fireworks. Gleason pressed the button on her shoulder radio.
"Unit 920 to any available blue team member, 1073?
No response.
Repeat, unit 920 to any available blue team member. 1073?
A distant truck engine raced, then a crash.
What the hell's going on, Gil?
The unmistakable boom of a shotgun reached them over the fields. 5 shots in 5 seconds. Gleason shot Skeet. She knew that sound well. She pressed the button on her shoulder radio.
920 to control, multiple 1057 at 1215 Potrero Road. Repeat, multiple 1057. Code 30, radio contact lost with blue team.
The courtyard was chaos as the Hummer roared back in from the garden and smashed headlong into the ambulance, sending glass and metal debris flying. It surged ahead, pushing the ambulance sideways at the mouth of the driveway, blocking the exit. The entire time, officers laid down sustained gunfire on it, pocking its body with bullet holes. The bullets didn't appear to have much effect, even though some of the Hummer's sensors now dangled loose on wires. It slalomed across the courtyard, finally locking in on an agent firing at it from the garage. The man stopped shooting and ran for cover through the doorway. The Hummer plowed through the entire wall after him and emerged out the far side, leaving shards of 2x4s and shattered walls toppling in its wake. Seebeck fired the last of his third clip into its rump as it roared back out into the garden. He added his own voice to the shouting and the cries of the injured.
Nathan!
Here, Pete!
Nathan came running across the courtyard with a shotgun and a box of shells in his hand. Several car trunks were wrenched open in the wreckage, and the officers raided them for heavier weapons. Seebeck pointed to the bomb squad truck.
Stay with Mr. Ross and make sure he gets out of here. He has information the FBI needs.
What about you?
I'll help with the wounded. Move!
Nathan gave him one last look, then raced off toward the bomb squad van. Seebeck dodged between damaged police vehicles and almost slipped on blood as he raced across the cobblestones. A severed arm lay next to a crumpled bumper. His mind had trouble wrapping itself around the sights and smells. Officers were trying to get a bleeding FBI agent out from under a smashed sedan before the Hummer returned. The wounded man screamed in agony and fear. Nearby, Seebeck saw Aaron Larson attended to by an FBI agent and another deputy. Larson looked to be in tremendous pain. He was standing up, sandwiched between 2 damaged patrol cars. Seebeck turned and called across the courtyard.
Get that truck over here! We need to pull these cars apart!
He holstered his pistol and ran to help. Shouted commands echoed from every corner of the courtyard.
I can't get anybody on radio!
Cell phones don't work either!
It's coming back in!
Decker climbed across the crumpled hood of his sedan.
Get the wounded into the vans! Fall back to the road!
Seebeck was sprinting across the middle of the courtyard when the Hummer roared in behind him through an opening between the house and garage, sending debris flying.
Pete, look out!
Gunfire erupted almost immediately. A bullet whined past Seebeck's head. He ducked, then turned to see the Hummer bearing down on him. It was almost on him already. He felt the bass rumble of its engine in his chest, the black grille racing straight toward him. Then it shuddered violently to a stop on the cobblestones just a foot away. Seebeck stood motionless, heart pounding, before the massive steel grill. His eyes focused on the Hummer's front vanity plate. AUTOM8D. Automated. It was smeared with blood. The plate suddenly began to recede as the Hummer shifted into reverse and backed away from him. The Hummer then roared forward again, passing Seebeck wide on the left and accelerating toward the FBI agent and deputy helping Aaron Larson. They scattered as Larson screamed. The crash scattered the cars across the courtyard, sending Larson's body hurtling like a rag doll. Seebeck stood motionless, in a state of shock in the middle of the courtyard. Amid all the screams and shouts, gunshots, and the roaring engine of the Hummer, he was still alive, and he didn't know why. Then, the familiar sound of racing V8 engines came to Seebeck's ears. 2 Ventura County police cruisers hurtled down the driveway from the front gate, rack lights flashing. They screeched to a stop next to the ambulance blocking the driveway. A male deputy jumped out of one and raced to retrieve Larson's body, while a female deputy leaned out of the passenger side of the other car and opened fire on the Hummer with a shotgun. Seebeck was dimly aware of someone pulling on his arms.
Pete!
He turned to see Deputy Gil Trivedi.
Larson's dead. We need to pull back.
Trivedi tugged Seebeck toward a nearby patrol car. A rumble came to his ears, and Seebeck turned to see the FBI's bomb squad truck with deputies and agents hanging off its armored bomb disposal trailer, accelerating across the littered courtyard. Mance leaned out off the trailer and jabbed a finger at Seebeck, then toward the exit. The bomb truck crashed through a nearby rose garden and headed out across the estate lawn. Seebeck snapped back to reality and turned to Trivedi.
Okay, got it.
They jumped into the patrol car while the black Hummer raced to intercept the bomb squad truck in the distance. From the front seat of the bomb squad truck, Ross saw the Hummer racing toward them like a torpedo, leaving twin ruts in the soft grass.
It's going to ram us, the agent driving shouted. I can't maneuver on this grass.
Ross faced him.
Turn toward it, head on.
The driver gave him a look.
It will avoid a head-on collision with a larger object.
How the hell do you know?
Because Sobel's probably using his game physics engine.
On the driver's blank look, he shouted,
Ram the Hummer, goddammit!
The driver looked into Ross's intense eyes. There was no doubting his confidence. The driver spun the wheel to aim head-on at the advancing Hummer. Agents and deputies hanging on to the bomb squad truck shouted at the driver. The Hummer accelerated straight toward their front grill. Then, it swerved aside at the last second, winging their front right fender with its rear quarter panel. A cheer went up in the truck. The driver accelerated straight toward the estate fence line. He glanced toward Ross.
How the hell did you know that?
Ross pointed and shouted,
Slow down!
The estate fence was wrought iron with a masonry base. They crashed through it, going at least 30, nosed down onto Potrero Road, and slammed into the ditch on the far side. Ross held his hands up and smashed against the windshield with the other two deputies sitting up front. They shattered it with their weight, then slammed back against the seat as the truck came to a complete stop. There were groans of pain from the wounded and the newly wounded. A shout.
What the fuck are you trying to do? Get us all killed?
Ross shook his head clear and could now hear approaching sirens. Lots of them. He looked at his hands. They were only slightly cut. He followed the other deputies out of the truck. They raced around the overturned bomb squad trailer to the estate side of the road. They could see the Hummer still on the other side of the fence. It wasn't following them, but was instead charging around the lawn like a raging bull, spinning and tearing up the turf. The officers opened fire on it again, emptying shotguns, pistols, an M16 rifle while shouting obscenities. The Hummer raced off toward the mansion. Ross covered his ears against the noise and looked up the road to see approaching emergency vehicles. It had begun. He knew there was no hope of containing the demon now, and guns were useless against it. Chapter 13. Demo. BBC, UK. Dead computer genius slays police, federal agents, Thousand Oaks, California. Authorities have surrounded a walled estate owned by the late Matthew Sobel, a leading computer game designer who died earlier this week of brain cancer. 6 law officers were killed and 19 others injured, serving a search warrant at the property. They were reportedly attacked by a computer-controlled SUV that still roams the grounds. Anderson's North Beach condo had 12-foot pressed tin ceilings, original wood floors, full-height windows with a fabulous view of the windows across the street, and enough Victorian